Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Last Friday afternoon, I got up from my desk and I walked over to the printer. I looked up at the television that hangs in our newsroom. I was kind of hoping to catch a glimpse of the soccer game between Germany and France, but you know what I saw instead.
This is an NBC News special report. Here's Lester Holt.
We're coming on the air to tell you about a situation unfolding right now in Paris where there have been a number of apparent attacks.
I checked Facebook. One of my French friends had simply posted, "Quelle horreur." I was born and raised in Germany, so I started texting friends who live in France. I stared at my Twitter feed. I felt sad and shocked and angry, scared. Of course, I wasn't alone.
And then I went to the gym after work
and saw something on the TV with a breaking news update.
I think I saw something on Twitter. I guess, luckily, most of the people I knew who were in Paris kind of updated on Facebook.
Facebook had already started using the I'm safe tool, and Twitter was going crazy with the hashtag porte ouverte.
My Facebook friends started changing their profile pictures in solidarity. So did yours, I'm sure. All week, I listened to the radio bringing us the latest from Paris, a city in mourning.
But this is a Monday morning like no other. News has been breaking this morning about the attacks that were carried out.
I looked at pictures of the victims. I wondered why they were all so beautiful. Almost immediately after the attacks, another thing started happening, though. It's to some extent an age of the 24-hour news cycle and social media phenomenon. And in happier days, I refer to it as think piece bingo. You probably know what I'm talking about. After any event of consequence, we almost immediately start dissecting what it means. We discuss and endlessly hash out how we should think about it. Somebody opines, "Here is what this means." "Not at all," comes the response almost right away. "Well, how about this? Nonsense." And on it goes. We argue, we bicker, we leave nasty comments, and we unfriend each other. Now, here's a question for you, a theory. What if all of this behavior was really motivated by our fear of death? I've had a book on my desk for a while. Reporter Alana Gordon had urged me to take a look at it. It's called The Worm at the Core, on the Role of Death in Life. And it builds on the thinking of cultural anthropologist Ernest Becker.
And what Becker argued is that people are unique in all of the animal kingdom because we are so smart that we actually realize that we exist.
Becker died in 1974. This is Sheldon Solomon. He is a professor of psychology at Skidmore College, and he wrote that book on my desk together with a few colleagues. Knowing that we exist is good, but
it's also terrifying because it makes us realize that we're going to die someday, that we could die at any time, and that really we're no significantly more enduring than lizards or potatoes.
Imagine if our inevitable death was the only thing we thought about. How could we function? So Solomon and his colleagues built on Becker's work and developed terror management theory. It argues that we find ways to minimize our existential terror. One way to do that is to embrace strong beliefs about the world around us, to give it order and meaning, to be part of a tribe or a nation that will persist over time. Immortality of sorts. And because there's so much at stake here, we will go to extraordinary lengths to maintain faith in our beliefs. Solomon set out to test this theory in experiments.
What we thought was actually very simple, and that is that if Becker's right, if our beliefs serve to minimize death anxiety, then we thought, well, what would happen if we reminded people of their mortality, perhaps by asking them to think about themselves dying, maybe by interviewing them in front of a funeral parlor? And so, for example, in one of our first experiments, we had Christian participants either reminded of death or something unpleasant, and then we asked them to judge other students who reported that they came either from Christian or Jewish families. And in the control condition, the students didn't differentiate between the target individuals based on their religion. However, when they were reminded of their death first, they liked fellow Christians a lot more, and they disliked Jewish targets a lot more. And that basic finding has nothing to do with Christianity. For example, we did some studies in Iran a decade ago where Iranians reminded of their mortality became more enthusiastic about suicide bombing and more willing to become a martyr themselves.
And Sheldon, how did you see this theory play out on Facebook, on social media, after the Paris attacks?
Well, I think it played out exactly as terror management theory would predict, and that is an outpouring of support and patriotism and national pride for the French and the Western democratic way of life. And of course, there's nothing wrong with that. More perniciously problematic, however, is the reflexive hostility and disdain for anything that is associated with Islam.
Is this always a bad thing, though? If I'm convinced that my way of life is the right way of life, and it will keep me alive, it will keep future generations alive, is it perhaps not about terror management in the sense that I'm afraid of my death, but that I want myself and others to go on living?
Yes, I think that's an absolutely good point, and one that we would not dispute. On the other hand, one of the things that Ernest Becker pointed out is that no culturally constructed vision of reality is ever capable of completely eradicating death anxiety. He called it a panic lurking beneath the surface of consciousness. And what we do with that residual death anxiety is to repress it, and then we project it onto other individuals that we declare the all-encompassing repository of evil. So the question is not so much, is it a bad thing to be proud of our way of life, but what's the psychological and physical toll that that pride takes on those around us, if that makes sense?
Since reading your book, I've been thinking a lot about my typical reactions. If, for example, I hear that somebody died in a car accident, my first question is often, did they wear a seatbelt? If I hear about somebody dying from a heart attack, I will ask, well, how old were they? Did they live a healthy life? So is this all about, I never quite thought about why I asked those questions, but now I'm thinking I want to assess my own risk here, right?
Well, I think that's quite right. And without claiming that everything that people do and think about is tied to death anxiety, we're pretty sure that lots of it is. And when you read about, you know, someone having a heart attack or dying in a car accident, you know, that makes thoughts of death very conscious. And one way to assuage our own anxiety, you know, is to hope that the person in the car accident wasn't wearing a seatbelt. You know, that the guy who had the heart attack, you know, was choking on a half dozen donuts and so on. You know, in the hopes that there's a rational explanation for those fatalities that might in turn imply that if we behave otherwise, we could be spared that fate.
And that's not really possible with terror attacks.
That's right. They're specifically designed, and they do it quite well, you know, to tear a gaping hole in the delicate, culturally constructed fabric of meaning that we each rely on to stand up in the morning. And what all terrorist attacks do is to really hit us with kind of a 1-2 punch of death reminders. One is the very real physical danger that those acts pose to any of us. And then there's the psychological affront of realizing that our way of life is being challenged both physically and psychologically.
I saw a lot of conversation on social media about, look at you, everybody is all upset about Paris, but when the same thing happened in Beirut, nobody cared. And I wondered about that sentiment in regards to terror management theory, because I'm wondering if we are more likely to be affected by things that happen to people who are more like us.
Well, absolutely. You know, we don't have to necessarily be happy with this fact, but it is still a fact, you know, that humans are territorial and tribal animals. And, you know, in fact, there's some research that suggests that when disasters befall other people who we consider to be our enemies, that actually helps assuage our own death anxieties.
What do we do about this? We can't do away with the fear of death. It's part of us. But is being aware of it, does that make it better if I know, oh, this is just my fear of death?
The question, the way we see it, is not getting rid of death anxiety, but understanding that when death anxiety becomes problematic is when we repress it and we're no longer conscious of it. And then it's manifested in ways that bear unfortunate psychological fruit, like when we despise people who are different.
Sheldon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sheldon Solomon is one of the authors of The Worm at the Core on the Role of Death in Life. Now, on to another human quality that we see emerge during terrible times, resilience. Psychologist George Bonanno is a pioneer in new research on how we deal with grief and trauma, and the thinking in those areas has changed pretty dramatically in recent years.
I think what we knew about these reactions for a long time came from the clinical world, came from only seeing patients. And my work and the work of a number of other people has focused on the broader population. And what we find is that most human beings are resilient.
How does grief express itself in most people?
Well, most people feel profound sadness. And sadness, it turns out, is very functional. It's very useful. Sadness enables us to kind of process what's happened. We turn our attention inward. We leave the world outside of us behind a little bit. And we really focus on the fact that the person is gone, and we have to reorganize our sense of the world as a world without that person.
And then what happens?
Then this response is kind of cyclical. It's oscillatory. So we go in and out of that state of sadness. So if somebody's sad for 2 months during a loss, it feels like they're sad day and night for 2 months. In reality, they're not. Sadness comes and go because it's an emotional reaction. We don't notice that because we're not paying attention always to these things. And over time, over weeks, that will gradually lessen. We still may feel sadness 5 years later, and some people often do. But it's a periodic, you know, an occasional feeling.
You make a big distinction in your writings on trauma about what we commonly refer to as traumatic events. And usually what we mean when we say that is a tragedy like a terror attack. And you make it clear that this is a potentially traumatic event. Explain that.
One of the reasons I'm very emphatic about that word is because surprisingly, a surprising number of potentially traumatic things happen to us on a regular basis. And we often forget these events. Human beings actually forget these things that happened. In our interviews, if you ask somebody, have you ever been held up at gunpoint? Have you ever seen another person die? And people will actually say no. And then 10 minutes later, they'll say, I remember now. I was held up at gunpoint, or I did see somebody die. And when we first began to do this research, you know, I thought this is kind of remarkable that human beings can forget these things. But in fact, it's because often we move on from these events. We're okay despite the distress of those events, and they recede into the background. So for any given event, it depends on many different things, not just who we are, but the many other factors in our lives, the level of stress, our genetic makeup, the context in when an event happens. And one event may be enormously traumatic for one person and not so traumatic for another person who experienced almost the same thing.
But in general, your research, even though it's on sad topics, so to speak, is hopeful in what it says about the human spirit.
I would say that's true, yes. In fact, when we began to do this research initially, I began this research about 25 years ago. I have to admit I wasn't keen on it because I thought, well, this is kind of depressing stuff. And as we did the research, right away we saw lots of resilience. We saw laughter. At the time in those early studies, we saw people laughing in between crying. And we thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. We developed ways to code that. We found it was nowhere in the literature, no real discussion of this. It was only seen as denial. But it turns out that most people are capable of moments of joy even when they're suffering greatly. And I think it really is a tremendous sign of how resilient we are.
Psychologist George Bonanno has written The Other Side of Sadness, What the New Science of Bereavement Tells Us About Life After Loss. As Paris deals with its grief, there is also a huge and important conference to prepare for. At the end of the month, the city is hosting a long-planned United Nations Climate Change Summit that some people believe could change the future of our planet. Representatives from around the world are aiming for the first time to hammer out a legally binding agreement that would limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. Carolyn Beeler takes a look at the impact the recent terrorist attacks could have on these historic negotiations.
The climate talks are on, and emphatically so. When reporters asked the French foreign minister less than a day after the attacks if the UN summit would be canceled, he responded, "No, no, 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 no." The negotiations will continue, but French authorities have banned public demonstrations in hard-to-secure outdoor spaces in Paris and other French cities. That includes a huge march scheduled in Paris the day before the climate talks are set to start.
Our concern is that the public voices that are really critical to making progress at the climate talks won't be allowed to be a part of them.
That's Jamie Henn, strategy and communications director for one of the march's main organizing groups, 350.org. Henn says an unpermitted act of civil disobedience planned at the negotiation site for the end of the conference has also been nixed. While he respects the need for security, Henn worries about authorities clamping down on civil liberties.
And so what we're looking for is more of a guarantee that while the French government should prioritize public safety, it's also prioritizing our civil liberties and the ability of civil society to take part in this process.
The French reaffirmed in a statement this week that the public should play a major role in the UN talks, but the impact of tightened security on the climate negotiations remains to be seen. University of East Anglia lecturer Heike Schroeder researches the role of observers at international climate change negotiations. She thinks protests can raise the profile of climate talks among the general public.
So someone who might not really be so concerned about climate change but sees, you know, on TV a massive demonstration happening will say, oh, yes, I remember, yes, climate change, we need to do something about it. So on that level, absolutely would there be an impact.
But she argues diplomats in Paris will be too busy haggling over the text of the agreement to register the lack of protesters outside.
Just because the negotiators are usually so shielded off from anything else that goes on in the world that they probably wouldn't notice.
Jackie Smith, an expert on social movements at the University of Pittsburgh, disagrees with Schroeder. Smith and some activists argue visible protests give governments with less bargaining power popular legitimacy to push for stronger carbon restrictions.
These protests can support governments like the government of Bolivia and really give them the support they need to really stand up to the pressure that they'll face when they oppose the policies of major governments.
Following failed international climate talks in Copenhagen in 2009, the Bolivian government strengthened ties with environmental groups and held a people's conference on climate change with those activists.
Bolivia has really been a leader in promoting more dramatic responses to climate change and really advancing the cause of what's called climate justice.
Even with tightened security measures, the terrorist attacks are sending a ripple of worry through conference attendees like Jani Stefansson. Stefansson lives in a remote town in Lapland in northern Sweden.
So I'm a bit concerned about being in crowded areas since the Paris actions lately, the very tragic ones.
She's representing the indigenous Sami people of Scandinavia at the talks, and she says she's scared, but not scared enough to stay home.
This is a too important event to ignore. And of course, I'm not going to be reckless. I'm not going to put myself in situations where something could happen. But You cannot just be afraid, because then the terrorists will have won.
Hundreds of thousands of activists will no longer crowd Parisian streets for a big march. But 350.org's Jamie Henn says they're already thinking about other ways to leave a mark.
That could look like everything from smaller gatherings that could be permitted to making noise in the streets in various ways, from banging on pots and pans to finding even more creative ways to make our voices heard.
With the conference starting on November 30th, activists have about a week and a half to brainstorm. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Last year, we met Michael Ross at the Rothman 8K race in Philadelphia. At the time, he was in chemotherapy treatment for stage 4 colon cancer, and he had already gone through a major surgery. His wife, Wendy Ross, was on the sidelines cheering him on. We have a great update on Michael, but first, let's take a listen back to our story from last year, which was produced by Laura Benchoff.
Runner!
When he said he wanted to still do it, even though he was going to be actively getting chemo, I will confess I tried to dissuade him, but when I realized he really wanted to do it, I just decided to support the effort.
I'm a sports medicine physician, and I happen to be a sports medicine physician who has colon cancer. Kind of a surprising diagnosis. You know, the first time I met with one oncologist, I was told that, you know, this is the survivability, you know, 50% of people make it this far. And I didn't want to hear that. I've always been active. I thought I was doing everything right. Ate well. I'm vegetarian for many, many years. Participate in triathlon. Stage 4 means it's spread outside the colon and to other parts of my body. So I still, even though the part of my colon has been removed that had the tumor in it, there's still some cancer cells living on the inside of my abdomen. And had surgery, had part of my colon removed. I subsequently started chemotherapy. The truth is, I don't feel terribly sick. I could sit around all day and worry about it. And I do that plenty, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning. But I think that maintaining, you know, the life that I want to maintain while I can is important. I have 2 boys.
This is Jacob. Ben.
I'm 11.
He's 9.
Even though I'm smaller. But
my feet are big.
Prior to being diagnosed, I was competing in triathlon and sprint distance, which is going very hard, but for relatively short distances compared to some of the longer distances. And not only me doing it, but me prescribing it for patients and doing exercise testing to help people do the same thing. And now here I am. I'm like, well, I'm just excited to be out, able to go out and run. We did make shirts with a giant semicolon on the front, because I have a semicolon. Part of it's gone. So
the semicolon brigade coming in right now. The Rothman Institute, AKT.
I feel pretty good now. I think the chemo is making my vocal cords go into a little bit of spasm, so it's hard to talk, but I feel great. I can't talk.
That was Michael Ross a year ago. He was going through chemotherapy at the time for stage 4 colon cancer. And I recently received an email from his wife, Wendy, with the title Potential Follow-Up Story. And I have to admit that my heart dropped for a moment, fearing the worst for Michael. But it turns out this was good news. Michael has had another major surgery that went really well. And he and Wendy stopped by to talk about how they are doing. Michael had a bit of trouble talking about what he's been through. It's still all very raw, so we're going to hear mostly from Wendy.
We went to several doctors and Michael's surgeons in New York. He's at a hospital where we went to medical school. And as soon as we met him, he was so positive. He didn't give Michael that dead man walking look. And that alone is priceless. Like, so during Michael's surgery, the second surgery, they took out everything that looked suspicious. They reconnected his colon and they infused hot chemo for like an hour and a half. And then when the pathology came back, actually none of it had been cancerous. I mean, it was cancerous originally. We knew that. But
the stuff that was left was not cancer.
the stuff that the chemo hadn't gotten looked pretty good. So we're in a much better place than we were a year ago. And we really are feeling so lucky. After the major surgery, one of the doctors said to him, well, you know, your core strength is only going to get back to like 80% of where it was. And he's looking at them and I can tell he's thinking, you know, we'll just see about that.
Like, I did a triathlon a year after I was diagnosed, and I did it. It wasn't my best race, but, you know, one of my goals this year is to qualify for nationals and get there again.
It helped Michael to keep up with all his activities, and it helped the kids to really see that he was living and not curled up somewhere, you know, thinking about dying. Yeah, so I think, you know, for us, it's really just about staying positive and accepting the support of others and really also keeping your sense of humor.
And now we're back to normal, hopefully.
Well, I don't think we were ever that normal, but we're certainly back. So,
I mean, everything Wendy said is true, but yeah, it's you can't have a bad day now.
Wendy and Michael Ross talking about Michael's recovery from colon cancer, and they told me they are really looking forward to Thanksgiving this year. Many families have special traditions around this celebration. Reporter Carolyn Beeler's family always passes around a basket of rolls first. That got Carolyn thinking about how baked goods get their unique texture. Soft and fluffy dinner rolls, crunchy artisan bread, a flaky pie crust. The ingredients are not all that different. She decided to investigate and visited a Philadelphia scientist turned baker.
So my name is Jamie Landers, and I am the owner and baker for Luscious Bakery Food Truck. We are inside the Luscious Bakery Food Truck. It's actually nice and spacious in here.
It smells amazing, too.
Landers specializes in brunch fare and was an aerospace engineer for 12 years before opening her bakery this summer. So I thought she was pretty well qualified to show me the science of bread, hands-on.
We are making pumpkin-seeded dinner rolls. So it's a lot like your standard dinner roll. It's going to be lightly crusty on the outside. It's going to have a nice sort of pillowy, airy texture on the inside.
Standing at the large stainless steel counter in her food truck, Lander starts by proofing yeast in warm water and honey.
And now it's got to rest.
And then she measures out the dry ingredients.
So we're going to do about 2¾ cups of bread flour.
Bread flour is a bit different than your typical all-purpose flour.
So the main difference is the protein content.
Lander says choosing the right flour is the first step in giving any baked good the right texture. A flour with more protein creates a chewier dough. A flour with less protein means airier, flakier dough.
So you go from a cake flour
that has 6-8% protein to an
all-purpose flour
with 10-12% protein
and whole wheat
that has 16% protein. But there's not actual gluten in flour. Gluten is what's called a composite protein made up of glutenin and gliadin. It's when you add water to flour that it coaxes those two wheat proteins together to form gluten.
And they're going to bond, and they're going to create these structures and networks. And these networks create the structure or elasticity of the bread.
So water plus flour makes gluten, but how you treat the dough after adding that water, that's the other key to a baked good's texture. For the pumpkin-seeded dinner rolls, Landers combines the wet ingredients with the dry ingredients and starts to work them together with practiced hands. The mixture starts off wet, then quickly turns into a rough dough, like a really pilly wool sweater, because the gluten bonds haven't started forming yet.
My arm's getting a good workout. Yeah. And you'll notice I've just been kneading for about 90 seconds here, and it already looks different. You can actually see the strands of gluten starting to form.
Landers kneads for about 10 minutes, explaining that she's working out the gluten networks, just like you work out your muscle fibers when you go to the gym.
We're stretching it, but not tearing it. That's going to create, again, a stronger gluten network.
The dough is getting smoother and shinier, the individual strands of gluten becoming less visible. When Landers presses it with her thumb, it bounces back. Now it's ready to rise for an hour. During the rise, the yeast will start to eat the honey and the starches in the dough and then burp out carbon dioxide and alcohol.
Now, because we already formed a gluten network by kneading it for 10 minutes, that's going to create a mesh or a net within it. And it's going to trap that carbon dioxide inside of it. And that's why we're getting that rise.
After another short kneading and dividing the dough into 12 dinner rolls, it's time for another hour-long rise.
All right, off to lunch.
That's just enough time for me to grab lunch and then return back to the food truck.
We're back. Oh my gosh, it smells amazing in here. Okay, are they done? They're ready?
They're ready. They're ready to come out. So they've been fully baked, and they're nice and brown and fully risen.
Okay, are you ready?
Yeah.
You guys want to try it?
Yes, please.
Carolyn was nice enough to bring me some of those rolls that day, and I have to say, they were delicious. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and we're going to think a little bit more about the Thanksgiving meal. When you lift that massive turkey out of the fridge and you're about to put it into the roasting pan, there's an important question to ponder. Should the turkey make a pit stop in the sink for a bath? A couple of years ago, food safety experts launched a public service campaign telling people, don't wash your chicken. And they were referring to poultry in general. Lots of home cooks balked.
Apparently, there are people out there who really want to wash their chicken. So this dug-in group that said, I've been doing it for 30 years this way, and I'm not going to stop. How dare you?
That's food microbiologist Jennifer Quinlan from Drexel University. She spoke with Tanya English for this story.
Cooks tell Quinlan that they use vinegar, lemon juice, all sorts of concoctions to rinse poultry.
You are not going to kill the bacteria.
It's heat at the proper temperature that kills pathogens and makes meat safe to eat. Food labels haven't caught up with the advice from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Some packaging still suggests that you rinse a whole bird. Quinlan's husband was solo recently and sent her a cell phone picture of the cooking instructions on a broiler chicken.
I said, but you didn't rinse it, did you? And he said, well, yeah. I said, you live with the woman who tells people not to wash their chicken and you rinsed your chicken. So that...
It might be that Quinlan gets pushback because she's a scientist and not a chef, but she is a mom.
I have cooked turkey for the last two Thanksgivings without rinsing it, and nobody said this turkey tastes unwashed, so...
Lots of people take their bird to the sink for a bath. Way back when, Julia Child did it.
Just run the water right through it, inside and out.
Bossy YouTube sensation Auntie Fee teaches people how to cook on a budget, and she rinses her chicken too.
Come on over here, okay? This is frozen chicken, okay? You want it frozen, but you want to wash it up, okay? Wash it up.
Washing poultry ups the chance that salmonella or campylobacter, carried along on a mist of water and chicken juice, will splash onto the kitchen counters or cross-contaminate nearby food. John Blanchet is a private chef with extra training in food safety. He keeps poultry in a plastic bag, then moves it directly to a cutting board or a pan when he's ready to season and cook.
The holidays and what we love about them have to do with tradition and memory, and sometimes science, you know, flies in the face of what grandma used to do, and so that can be tricky for people.
Sure, love your grandma, but Blanchet says trust the food scientist. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and if you're looking for something to talk about around the Thanksgiving table, perhaps with your college-bound cousins, how about career options? Unsexy career options, to be more specific. The American agriculture industry has a problem. It's a fast-growing high-tech field, and companies are adding a lot of jobs, but they can't find qualified college grads to fill them. From Kansas City, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon has more.
When Colorado State University student Aubrielle Jones tells her friends she's studying agriculture, she sometimes gets a puzzled look.
Oh, you're learning about corn, right? Oh, you're learning about how cows eat. Things like that.
But it's way more than that. Just check out her major.
My major is agricultural literacy. I have a minor in global and environmental sustainability, and then another minor in agricultural resource economics.
It's a mouthful. But it's a combination of degrees that likely sets Jones up for a pretty easy job hunt when she graduates in the spring. See, graduates with agricultural degrees are in high demand and will be for the foreseeable future.
I mean, it's very encouraging. Yeah, most definitely. I think it's amazing that those numbers are rising, and so that gives more opportunities.
A recent report from Purdue University and the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows there'll be close to 60,000 jobs opening up in ag and food sectors each year for the next 5 years. But here's the problem. There's not enough grads like Jones to fill them. The report projects about 2 open jobs for every qualified graduate.
Our students in animal science, some of them have 2 and 3 job offers when they leave.
Kevin Pond directs CSU's Department of Animal Science. He says part of the problem is perception. Young people just don't think of agriculture as a growing field or an area with sunny job prospects. Students, even at this land-grant university, are increasingly urban. Most don't come from a farm background.
The truth is, in animal science, it's 80% female. It's 90% urban, and our new minority is a white male from a rural background. Crazy to think.
There's still the stereotype of the farmer in manure-covered overalls driving an old tractor, Pond says. Helping prospective students see ag as a modern, potentially lucrative field of study is part of the school's sales pitch. The jobs opening up are highly skilled, and a lot of times they're at Fortune 500 companies. They're in marketing, food safety, plant science, and veterinary medicine.
It's no longer menial labor that is at a low salary. Their salaries are going up and up and up because of the scarcity.
Agriculture programs at land-grant universities are focusing on science in a bid to stay relevant, Pond says, even as it takes fewer people to run farms and ranches.
Well, if you have 1% of your population is feeding the other 99%, if we're relying on that pool to fill our classrooms, we're going to be a dying college.
I think recruitment is a problem.
Krista Harden is second in command for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She says private companies need to do a better job wooing students and working with public universities. And she says part of the problem in filling these jobs is where they are. Many recent college grads look to major cities for their first jobs, Harden says, not rural Illinois, for example.
Even our mega big agribusinesses are often in smaller cities and in rural locations, and the jobs they have may be out and a grain elevator or a buying point or a smaller city. And so how do you attract young people?
CSU senior Aubrielle Jones says she's already being recruited, but her passions are in local food and organic agriculture. So when food giants like Tyson or ConAgra come knocking...
Honestly, I feel like the businesses and industries that have come to me are ones that I'm not particularly interested in. They're mostly like the large ag industries and things like that.
That mismatch in values is part of what's leaving big food companies with vacant jobs, even as food remains a hot topic. Those same friends who think all she does is study corn, over the years at CSU, they've come around.
The thing that I've really noticed about my friends over the past couple of years is that they're becoming way more interested in the food that they're eating than they were at the beginning.
It'll take a lot more of those friends turning a casual interest in food into a degree in agricultural science to eventually fill the gap. For The Pulse, I'm Luke Runyon.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Maiken Scott. Pretty much anywhere you go this time of year, you are reminded to get a flu shot. It's free, the signs practically scream. Get it now, right here, at the store. How about at your office? But it's tough to convince people who are suffering from what we could perhaps call flu shot avoidance disorder.
The last time I got a flu shot, I actually got sick. This was maybe about 2 years ago because I haven't gotten one since.
Right.
I think I'm going to take my chances.
Only about half of Americans get the vaccine each year. Public health people try lots and lots of things to make the flu shot as convenient and cheap as possible. Tanya English went to a free drive-through clinic at the Hershey Medical Center in central Pennsylvania.
So we have 4 lanes of travel. The first 2 lanes we can take either adults or pediatrics. The third lane we have some shuttles coming. My name's Paula Labonte, and I'm the nurse manager of employee health and employee safety.
Why not just set up a tent or go inside a gym somewhere? Why do it this way?
We can get people in and get them out.
We need assistance.
parents in the kids' corner.
Uh-oh, people are running a little bit. What do we think's going on?
I don't know, but we have EMS down there, so we're good. We had a small child in a kung fu pose a while ago. He looked like he was going to fight, and he really didn't want the flu shot, and his family wanted him to get that flu shot. So we said we had a special corner set up for kids that are anxious and just need that little bit of extra attention.
It's quick, and I give you a Band-Aid, okay?
No!
My name is Paula. I'm a nurse here at the Hershey Med Center, and I'm going to help give you your vaccines today. I'm going to give you a copy of this yellow form. There is a little notice here that says where you got your shot, the lot number, and who the manufacturer is.
Okay.
Make a copy of it for yourself. Give a copy to your regular doctor if you have one.
All right.
Okay?
Yep, sounds good.
So we're going to get your shot, and I'll sign it.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Going to have you look away if that needles bother you.
I'm Dahlia Diaz-Zuria. I wasn't sure if it was going to be sanitary.
Sure. I've never done it in a car either.
Yeah.
So I had a couple of people who were like, should I be doing this in my car? How do you answer that?
We've got alcohol wipes. We've got gloves down there. And we're using good hand hygiene. I'd say it's just as good as the doctor's office. And in some cases, it might be faster.
Do you have any questions about the flu shot?
No, ma'am. My name is Denise Welch Brock, and I brought the kids down. My baby is 7. Her name is Denalia. My 10-year-old is Jalian, and my 16-year-old is Diabre. It doesn't have the hospital environment or the pharmacy environment. It just makes them feel more comfortable.
Okay, girls, how did that go?
It was nice.
No problem.
It was easy.
Didn't hurt at all?
No, not at all.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And you have a great day. You can pull right on up.
Tanya English visiting a flu shot drive-through clinic in central Pennsylvania. And hey, if you did get a flu shot this season already, would you let us know how much you paid for it? We're trying to collect some data on that. You can do so on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thanksgiving weekend kicks off the holiday shopping season, and every year there's one toy that will make otherwise meek moms go to war. Toy fads come and go. Who remembers Tickle Me Elmo?
Oh, he tickled Elmo! Give Elmo a break, please!
But one toy that has disappeared from our shelves might be making a comeback. It has inspired Nobel Prize winners and perhaps started a few fires. I'm talking, of course, about the chemistry set. Early ones included fun stuff like uranium ore. And there is an effort to build a modern version. Here's Todd Bookman.
We're going to start with what I think is required of any decent chemistry set story, which is a small explosion.
So my brother is 2 years younger. He's also a bit of a science nerd. And we read things like in Boy's Life and in various magazines that would describe experiments. And then we'd try to repeat them.
This is Michelle Francel, a chemistry professor at Bryn Mawr College.
So we do this in the downstairs basement bathroom and sort of set our stuff up on the sink. And one of the things we really wanted to do was separate water into hydrogen and oxygen.
So they passed an electric current through the water and then captured the hydrogen gas in a tube. But to check if it was done right, you need to introduce a flame.
And so we did this, and it tested positive and explosively positive. And there was kind of this big whoosh of flame, and my brother's eyebrows and sort of his little crew cut got singed. And we cleaned everything up, and I lived in fear that my mother would notice the singed eyebrows. But with 6 kids, as long as no one was bleeding, apparently she didn't notice.
Like lots of scientists, Francel credits those early mishaps with developing her sense of curiosity. But she's seen less and less scientific moxie in her undergrads.
So I think students are coming far too cautious and far less willing to just stick their hands on something and see what happens.
There's no sense in knowing something unless you understand it.
The all-new, completely different Gilbert chemistry sets. With a volcano that erupts.
A There are no real stats on when it sold best, but most people agree the years before and after World War II were perhaps peak chemistry set. By the 1960s and 70s, there seems to be a decline in popularity, coinciding with America's waning passion for science, rising concern about toxic substances, and better entertainment options for children. So while they're not exactly starting at rock bottom, anyone trying to build a 21st century chemistry set does have the benefit of a clean slate. They can appeal to a whole new generation who maybe hasn't ever seen one and use technology to draw them in.
So we have some cool stuff. Like, for example, what we provide you a virtual reality headset.
This is Vasily Filipov, a Russian mathematician turned educational toy entrepreneur. He just launched the MEL chemistry set, which, along with the headset, comes with traditional components, a couple of beakers, safety glasses, syringes. There are small vials of chemicals like ammonium chloride and zinc powder, everything neatly packaged and labeled. It also includes a little plastic lens that clips onto a smartphone camera. Filipov sets up a crystal-growing experiment involving tin chloride and electrodes. Then he has me put the phone in position just above the Petri dish.
Close, it's just half an inch, not more. Even more closer. So it's really, really, really close.
The lens zooms in to capture really stunning video of the chemical reaction. If you're 12 or, say, 34, it's the type of thing you'd want to share on Facebook or Twitter.
We help them as much as possible to make nice videos. Because if you have done something cool, you want to share it. It's natural. You've seen something cool, you want everyone knows that you have done something cool.
The set runs about $75 and works on a subscription model, with new experiments arriving by mail each month. You can make a snake out of sugar, turn flames different colors, or concoct some sort of magic mud. And there's an app to follow along with so you can understand what's happening on a molecular level. Filipov's parents encouraged him to play with chemistry sets when he was young, and now he does the same with his four children.
It's also very important how we spend time with them. For kids, that's a signal what parents do with them. So, and that's if you spend at least half an hour or an hour every weekend, that's a lot. I mean, it's like that could change their life. That's why I like it.
There was a time when kids would have had every reason to think science could change their lives and the world. The space race, Dow and DuPont, better living through chemistry, right? But today, a lot of people would say the answer to the world's problems aren't hidden in the periodic table. They're going to be found in algorithms, in code.
Yeah, I think we are in a moment in which we do see the hands-on experience that is important is perhaps being one that is in front of a computer. That, you know, you are typing with your hands rather than manipulating chemicals with your hands.
Aaron McLeary is museum director at Philadelphia's Chemical Heritage Foundation, which has a big collection of antique chemistry sets. She pushes back on the idea that these educational toys have lost their standing. A well-designed set coupled with the right technology is still going to draw kids in.
They're like a dollhouse, but for science. You know, dollhouses are extremely appealing to many people as sort of visual artifacts. They're like everything, but it's so tiny and precise and it's perfect and it's in miniature and it takes you into this imaginative place. You know, these science sets are a little laboratory in miniature. They have everything you need. You can just open it and go.
And as for what can go wrong, Professor Michelle Franzel says parents shouldn't worry about the small chance for explosions or lost eyebrows.
We accept risk in a lot of places, like baseball, sports. Kids hurt themselves playing those things, and yet we don't think that that's a bad idea for them to be doing. And so I think we have to accept a little bit of risk when they play with science.
She adds that most of what comes in today's chemistry sets, you could safely feed to the family cat. Those are her words, not mine. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Tanin Dariush is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Joel Patterson is the managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and our partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.